Artificial intelligence, facial recognition, lightning-fast networks. They're here today. They are upending companies, transforming the consumer experience, and challenging the way that lawmakers craft policy. The pace of technological change is dizzying. So how are some of the world's leading companies orienting themselves in this new world? Stay tuned for an upcoming special branded episode of Global Translations, brought to you by Citi.
When social media platforms like Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube came online in the early 2000s, it was hard to imagine the outsized impact they would have today.
They're credited with helping to spark the Arab Spring. Now, social media sites are serving as the front line in a different revolution.
In the days after it went viral, Twitter reported that more than 1.7 million people had posted a hashtag MeToo message.
The hashtag Black Lives Matter was one of the most tweeted news hashtags in 2015.
We're also going to look at how the Parkland generation is using social media to galvanize and organize.
Twitter and WhatsApp are still the main stages for Sudan's information war.
Causes like the Arab Spring, MeToo, Black Lives Matter, and even the latest protests out of Sudan became mass movements thanks to the proliferation of these platforms in our everyday lives. As the number of users grew, so did the platform's influence. But at some point in the last few years, it became clear that even as people were using the platforms to promote social movements and democracy, bad actors were finding a way to take advantage, too.
We're taking a closer look at just how Russian trolls are managing to successfully flood social media with fake news.
A lot of this racist narrative is building in chat rooms online.
Additional sites like 4chan, 8chan, and Reddit also draw racist and anti-Semitic rants.
Who then use social media to both become more extreme in their views and also then organize their crimes.
From inciting hatred to spreading misinformation, they fueled trends that have the potential to destabilize societies. And that led to calls for governments to do something. But government involvement comes with a host of other issues. Free speech violations and the prospect of policing thought are just a couple of concerns. Not to mention questions about the basic competence of lawmakers to regulate something they don't always understand.
What if they wake up in 3 weeks, you know, and Donald Trump Jr. is running Facebook?
If someone was testifying as a doctor and people were asking them, well, is my heart located in my feet? People would laugh. And that's the level of sophistication that many members of Congress showed.
We just have to always make sure we democracy-proof whatever regulation we're creating.
It's still a tool that can be used for censoring people.
I don't think the Trump administration is serious about technology.
Is it possible to rein in the bad actors, whose objective is to sow division and stoke hatreds, without stifling free speech and innovation? From Politico, this is Global Translations. I'm Louisa Savage. In this episode, we'll hear viewpoints from Silicon Valley, the halls of Congress, and the European Union to help us navigate where this increasingly complicated issue is headed. But right now, I'm here with Nancy Scola, Politico's senior tech reporter. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, Louisa.
So, Nancy, one of the reasons we're hearing so much about social media regulation right now in Washington is because of President Donald Trump and his tweets.
That's right. And there are a lot of people that credit Trump's surprising win in 2016 to Twitter and the way he used Twitter effectively to bring his message directly to voters.
I asked somebody, what do you think I'd do without social media? Would I be here? Because I said, I think so.
This has certainly been the Twitter presidency, yet President Trump has a beef with the very same platforms that in many ways propelled him into office, so much so that he recently held a social media summit at the White House.
I don't know if you call it influence. I don't know if you call it power, but whatever it is, we're in the White House.
He did. And I spoke with Stephen Overly, who's one of our Politico tech reporters, about the event. And I think it's fair to say it wasn't your normal White House summit.
So there's been this longstanding criticism from the Trump administration that Silicon Valley social media companies are out to censor conservatives, that they're there to sort of suppress their political viewpoints and really boost a liberal point of view. And a lot of this is driven by this idea that Silicon Valley is simply anti-Trump. And so the White House organized what they branded as a social media summit to bring together what they call digital leaders to discuss this issue of social media censorship and political censorship.
Each of you is fulfilling a vital role in our nation. You're challenging the media gatekeepers and the corporate censors to bring the facts straight to the American people, and that's what you're doing.
You know, you saw administration officials in the front row of the audience, people like Steve Mnuchin from Treasury, people like Wilbur Ross from the Commerce Department. But in that same room were online personalities like Diamond and Silk, who have a very popular video show where they tout President Trump and his policies. You had Ali Alexander, who's sort of an online conservative pundit, who most famously sort of said Kamala Harris is not an American black. And you also had James O'Keefe, who's the head of Project Veritas, which sort of does these expose-style videos that critics have said are heavily edited and biased. And so you had sort of this collection of people in the room, and what they had in common is that they all support the president. At the end of the day, they have some complaints about how they're being treated on these platforms.
I was picking up unbelievable amounts of people, and I'm hotter now than I was then, okay?
President Trump called Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri to the stage, who's really emerged as his go-to on this whole anti-conservative bias movement.
You and I know the truth is that the social media giants would love to shut us down. They would love to shut us up. They would love to shut him up more than anything else, and we can't let them.
By hosting these social media pundits, by sort of elevating their concerns about bias, are they lending legitimacy to an issue that doesn't really exist?
So this complaint that Twitter and Facebook are biased against conservatives is something we've actually been hearing for years. This was part of the context around the 2016 election, that the platforms favored Hillary Clinton and Democrats in that race.
But how can a platform favor a candidate? What does that even mean?
So the argument is that these platforms now are so big that they have to make choices about curating content, deciding what accounts to feature, what tweets to promote. And conservatives say that consistently these platforms make choices that make it harder to find what they post, make it harder to find their accounts.
Is there any actual evidence of that?
So there's a bit. Twitter, for example, has admitted that they made some changes to their search algorithm that made it harder to find Republican members of Congress. But there's not evidence of the sort of sweeping, systematic discrimination of conservatives that conservatives allege.
Okay, so can you walk us through what the main problems are that Congress and this White House are trying to address?
So the main law governing how these platforms operate is something called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And that's a law that predates these companies. It was passed all the way back in 1996. And what it says is that online platforms like Twitter and Facebook aren't immediately responsible for what users post to them. And this law is credited with the creation and growth of tech companies in the United States. It's unlikely that companies like Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube could exist if they had to check every single piece of content before it's posted. On the other hand, there are people who argue that tech platforms have used this law as a shield to avoid taking responsibility for a lot of the vitriol on their sites.
So right now in Washington, we have a Republican White House, a Democratic House, a Republican Senate. What does that mean for the conversation around social media platform liability?
So right now we're at the stage of this discussion that involves a lot of yelling. The CEOs and top officials of these companies have been hauled before Congress to get a lashing from everything over hate speech to violent content to alleged allegations of political bias.
So does Silicon Valley have any defenders left? It sounds like both parties are quite fed up.
So there are a few defenders left of Silicon Valley in Washington, and Congressman Ro Khanna is one of them. Before Congressman Khanna came to Washington, he was a lawyer in the Bay Area. And he's come to D.C. not as a black and white defender of the industry. Instead, he critiques them. He points out where they've gone wrong and how they could get better.
So like any new technology, the technology can be either used to promote the social good or it can be abused for negative purposes. And I don't think there was a sufficient recognition about the potential for abuse until recently. We have to consider how fast these things scaled. I mean, I remember back in the early 2000s, Facebook had maybe 100,000 people on their platform. Now they're bigger than China. They have 2 billion people. And so I think the regulations and thoughtful laws did not keep up with the pace of growth of many of these companies.
If we look at some of the political anger right now directed at some of these companies, is there any responsibility that Washington bears because it was so hands-off?
Yes, I think that Washington should have been more proactive in having an Internet Bill of Rights to safeguard people's privacies. I think that we could have gotten ahead of the curve if we had strong privacy regulations. We should have had a stronger antitrust enforcement. In retrospect, the FTC should have absolutely scrutinized Facebook's merger with Instagram and WhatsApp and should have cast a much more critical eye to a monopoly being formed through acquisition.
As someone who sits sort of uniquely at the overlap between Silicon Valley and Washington, how do you explain to folks who maybe don't have that sort of perspective of what the relationship is right now between Silicon Valley and Washington, D.C.?
My sense is there is a mistrust on the and to Washington. There is a concern that the tech companies have not done a good enough job to protect people's privacy, that they haven't done a good enough job to create economic opportunity across the country in communities of color or rural America, and that there are antitrust issues with them privileging their own products or their own platforms. In the terms of Silicon Valley, there's a concern about technological illiteracy, that most members of Congress don't really understand technology. You've had members of Congress not know the difference between Apple and Google and who makes the iPhone. You've had members of the Senate not understand how Facebook makes money. So there's a real concern that Congress is not up to the task of writing laws or making policy for a 21st century economy.
And this is a global problem, and other countries are grappling with it too. But here in the United States, there's a lot of skepticism about how they're approaching it.
For sure, especially when it comes to Europe's more hands-on approach. And Congressman Khanna says that approach simply just doesn't make any sense for the United States.
France doesn't have a First Amendment, and speech is far less protected in Europe. And that has been one of the reasons they don't have a technology economy. I mean, Europe is pretty irrelevant when it comes to innovation and new technology. I would argue the United States has succeeded, and then China has because of just state-based capitalism and propping up companies like Baidu and Alibaba and Tencent. But Europe has been very stagnant in the new economy. So I'm not sure I would look to Europe as a model, but if they have good ideas, certainly they're worth considering.
Tell me more about Europe's ideas here, good or bad.
So the debate in Europe is much further along. There's not the same expectations of free speech online as we might have in the United States. So they're really kind of getting into the weeds of figuring out what can government dictate to these social media platforms about what's allowed to stay up, what needs to be taken down, how quickly companies need to act.
We saw a very dangerous combination of terrorism and migration wave in the EU. It increased incredibly the level of hate speech online in almost all the member states.
I spoke with Vera Jourova. She's more or less the Attorney General of Europe. And her argument is that the United States can afford hate speech, but Europe doesn't have that luxury.
When you were at Brookings a handful of weeks back in here in Washington, D.C., and you said the United States can afford hate speech, Europe can't. What did you mean by that?
What we see in Europe, there are some old scars which have not been healed yet after the Second World War and difficult times of the 20th century. And suddenly the online world as if woke up the old demons, and we see and hear it everywhere, and that's why it's not a new thing now that we try to tame these demons. We have in all criminal laws in all EU member states, we have some speech which is prohibited, which can be criminalized, and so for very strong reason we have such legislation, because this might be easily used, this hate speech and verbal violence could be easily used against some groups of people or some individuals.
So obviously a very different approach from the United States and a different context in terms of their constitutions and their laws, but also a different historical context when it comes to hate speech, right?
Absolutely. And much of that comes out of World War II. The argument in Europe is that speech was used to incite violence, and that ended up in a world war.
That's why we want Facebook and other companies which agreed to cooperate against in the fight against hate speech. That's why we want them to be active in all the member states, to understand the nature of the hatred, to understand the language, to understand the domestic laws, and to act where necessary. And where necessary is absolutely crucial here to mention, because we don't want them to remove all the hate messaging which appears, because we only want the prohibited by the law hate speech to be removed.
So, Nancy, people were basically breaking pre-existing European laws, but they were doing it online now.
Exactly. And Commissioner Rova's point is that regulation needed to be updated to keep pace with those changes.
We agreed on this mechanism, on this code of conduct against hate speech in spring 2016. Millions of people were endangered because in 2016, when I think about the moment when we agreed on the code of conduct against hate speech, the hatred online had such intensity that it really, we were close from jumping this violence from online world to the real life. Don't we authorize it by not touching it, not acting against it in online world? So we have numerous attacks in numerous member states. We have several political murders already. Several politicians were murdered. And it was always in the atmosphere of all the victims in the political world were extremely affected by online violence. When I hear the women who are discouraged at this moment before going to politics or to journalism because they are such easy and such frequent targets of online violence, and it is silencing them, it goes against internet as the fantastic open source of information and communication. Don't you think so?
To Commissioner Yourova's last point, I spoke with Paris Martineau. She covers online platforms and social media manipulation for Wired, and she spoke about what it feels like when you become a target of one of these online firestorms, and it begins to affect your offline life and your ability to do your job.
I kind of received a tip that there were kind of these networks, connected networks of Twitter accounts that were retweeting and amplifying conspiracy theorist content, a lot of disinformation regarding some, I think, like state elections that were happening back at the time. So I think I wrote some story about that and how all of them seemed to be connected to this one account. So I think I published some story on that, and then the whole network kind of sprung to life and spent months like attacking me.
How did it feel to be the target of that sort of campaign?
Yeah, it was a little terrifying. I'd never had that many, I'd never had harassment at that kind of scale before. And I remember waking up that morning and being like, oh my God, I can't even, like, I'd delete the Twitter app off my phone because it was causing my phone to freak out. But the one thing I was concerned about was my family. They still have, I don't know, some of those weird sites online still might have some of their information. And I remember calling them and being like, there might be some strange people where you live. Please lock the doors. Be careful.
It's amazing because when you describe, okay, none of this is real, at the same time, people show up at people's houses, people show up at pizza places in DC to, you know, at some point it does become real.
It's just like the whole fabric of reality is broken in some way. And it makes it even harder to discern when or when not you should be concerned. When we are reporting on disinformation or the actions of online extremists or something that has happened online, you have to ask yourself, like, okay, is this conspiracy theory that I see like pushed on Twitter or Facebook or something at scale by a bunch of people, are those real people? Do they really believe it? Are all these YouTube views that I've seen on this top trending video real and it's actually trending and something worth reporting on? Or is it fake and designed to get me to see that a lot of people are interested and then write about it? So then a lot of people actually become interested because they read it and then Google those words. And it just kind of makes every action more paralyzing.
What happened to Paris certainly shows the negative real-world consequences of social media, and it certainly helps make the case for regulation. But at the same time, the world has had some experience with what happens when governments start exerting influence over what people can see or read.
I spoke about that with Professor Heidi Twerick. She's a professor of history at the University of British Columbia.
Tools in social media that we thought were really utopian, could promote democracy, became tools for demagogues and dictators.
And she spoke about how the rise of Nazi Germany might not have been possible without the German government having earlier adopted new rules that gave them control over radio.
In the early 1920s, when we have the Democratic Weimar Republic, that's when you have the first attempts to regulate this new industry of spoken radio. And there's one main bureaucrat, a man called Hans Bredel, who's charged with figuring out, okay, how do we regulate this new industry? The Weimar Republic is pretty febrile. There are lots of political uprisings on the far right and the far left. And Bredel thinks, okay, what we have to do with radio is actually keep news pretty much out of it, because that might stoke more panic. It might push these political uprisings. Instead, we could use radio as a kind of savior of the nation. It can broadcast education and entertainment. It can be sort of an uplift for the masses. So regulation gives the state a sort of light touch initially, supervision over content. And his ideas were really well-meaning democratic ideas that you had to supervise this content to preserve democracy, to prevent too many violent uprisings. But ironically, what that means when the Nazis come to power in January of 1933, they have immediate control over the content of radio. Very well-intentioned regulation can just have terrible unintended consequences. Brido never thought that the regulation he was instituting to save democracy would actually be used to undermine it.
So after hearing from Professor Twerk, I decided to sit down with someone who's studying the modern implications of government regulation of media, in this case, social media.
I think the question people need to ask themselves is the status quo unacceptable?
And that's Joshua Tucker. He's a professor at NYU, and he's also the co-director of the Social Media and Political Participation Lab, otherwise known as SMAP Lab.
It's well within the platform's rights as sort of private companies to say what is acceptable and not acceptable behavior on the platforms. And so I think part of this discussion we get caught up with is not like what should the platform's policy be in terms of hate speech, but like what the enforcement is and is it actually being taken down quickly enough. But again, from a politics point of view, it does get dicey when you get into this situation about where you draw the line between what is political speech and what is hate speech. And obviously there's a bit of, you know, the seven dirty words, we know it when we see it to this, right? There are obviously things that I don't think any reasonable people would disagree about. You know, everybody who's sort of arguing at this point for giving greater and greater control to Facebook or greater and greater mandate for Facebook to remove information from the platform should think about, you know, what if they wake up in 3 weeks and Donald Trump Jr. is running Facebook and has, you know, and Zuckerberg has been removed and he's been replaced by, you know, close allies of the president. What kind of power would you want Facebook to have to control information in that particular thing?
We asked all the major social media platforms what they thought of these questions, and only one agreed to sit down and discuss them. We'll hear from executives at Twitter after the break.
Nearly 90% of executives surveyed by MIT and Deloitte say digital disruption is coming for their companies. So what's it like running a 200-year-old financial services firm while confronting and embracing today's rapid shifts in technology? One thing is certain, you can't bank on yesterday's success.
We are in an extinction phase. There's no doubt about it. When technologies change and, you know, when human behavior changes to the extent that is occurring right now in 2019, if you can't meet those expectations, then, you know, you become obsolete.
The pace of change is only speeding up. 90% of the world's data has been created in the last 2 years. There are now more mobile phone connections than people. And consumers have double the interactions with brands on mobile devices than anywhere else, according to Google. Stephen Bird, the CEO of Citi's Global Consumer Bank, sees those trends, and he's formed a singular mission: make the bank forward compatible.
What is it that makes a company forward compatible? You know, you have to create a new culture. We have to be able to shine a light on the potential to either grow in a successful way or go extinct. We have to bring in new talent, people who can come in and challenge us, challenge our model, and that's what I'm working on.
I'm Carol Zimmer. Stay tuned for our second branded installment of Global Translations, brought to you by our sponsor, Citi. We'll be looking at how consumer behavior, artificial intelligence, and faster networks are transforming companies and policy in this fiercely competitive world. We'll hear from Stephen Bird, the CEO of Citi's Global Consumer Bank, and Thomas Kurian, the CEO of Google Cloud. Look out for that episode on August 1st, wherever you listen to this podcast.
Clearly, the scale of the problem is really huge. So what are the contours of potential solutions?
One of the things I've heard again and again while reporting on this topic is that this is a global problem and it's going to require global solutions. One point of discussion happening right now is whether or not we need new international institutions to be able to cope with platforms as widespread as Twitter and Facebook. Here's Professor Twerick again from the University of British Columbia.
One of the suggestions that I've made with a few other people is the idea of social media councils. We saw how tools, which would essentially be institutions that would require representatives from the large social media companies and from various representatives of civil society to show up. Now, government in this model wouldn't really get to dictate what is discussed, but would push those groups to come together and think about various commitments that the government could then hold them to. And so there may be, that's the sort of role that maybe government can play, is ensuring that what social media companies say they're going to do is what they actually end up doing. But from the perspective of some countries that want to make sure that their national legislation, like for example in the case of Canada with embedding multiculturalism, they would probably want to see something national that could then really pay tribute to the ways that Canada specifically thinks about some of these problems rather than, say, the United States, Australia, Europe, etc.
So, Nancy, these social media platforms right now, they're being squeezed. They're in a tough spot.
Absolutely. And they argue they're sort of damned if they do, damned if they don't. If they leave content up, they get in trouble for it. If they take it down, they get yelled at too.
And then you have people like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi declaring that the era of self-regulation is over. People are calling them dangerous.
I think we're seeing a reckoning with the idea that these companies are just much more powerful than we ever imagined them to be, and that power is manifested both in controlling a lot of the information that the American public sees and how they compete with other companies. So that's sparking calls, exactly as you say, to have government do something about the firms.
So as all these debates are heating up on the national stage, you had the opportunity to sit down with executives from Twitter and discuss how they're navigating the political landscape.
That's right. I spoke with Nick Pickles. He's the global senior strategist for public policy at Twitter. And Nick came to the studio straight from testifying on Capitol Hill. He talked to me about some of the challenges that Twitter is facing as it tries to make decisions about how to handle online content.
Ultimately, we have a range of rules, and being uncomfortable is part of the job. Like, we're going to have to make difficult decisions about the kind of things we do and don't allow. It's incumbent on us to actually, I think this is perhaps the biggest shift in the industry, is just because it's uncomfortable isn't an excuse to not do anything. And I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, some people felt like that, but now it's, we live and breathe this every day. And so we've actually got to embrace that difficulty and make sure that we're thinking really thoughtfully about, I think the hard thing is not just solving the problem in front of you, but how do you solve the problem that's going to be 5 years down the line?
Is there any sort of additional guidance that might come in the form of regulation that Twitter would be open to in the United States?
Well, I think there's definitely things, you know, look at privacy, for example, where there is absolutely a benefit in having a federal standard rather than having lots of fragmented state-level law. But there's a broader question, I think, around sometimes what's the policy challenge we're trying to solve? Is it something that's difficult for governments, so they're trying to move it to social media companies? Is it about giving our users more transparency? In some ways, actually, some laws prohibit you from sharing more data because they are, you know, in the case of, say, privacy law, there's a really difficult balance to strike there. And then finally, how do we, you know, where regulation actually does move into this place, how do we protect an open, competitive global internet? And I think one of the things that really worries me is that a lot of the proposals you hear talked about there's a real risk that you lock in. You know, the internet, the consumer internet's 20, 30 years old. Social media is barely 15 years old. We're just at the beginning of the information century. And depending on the regulatory steps you take now, you pull the ladder up and basically you're left with the companies you have now and that's it. And I think one of the really hard battles we've got to figure out is you need to preserve competition. Twitter's the smallest of the big companies or the biggest of the small companies, depending which room we're in. And the regulatory frameworks that protected us growing is the same framework that we need to protect the next Twitter, the next Facebook. And I think the risk is that if you throw the baby out with the bathwater, you lose that competition and that open internet. Long term, that's bad for everyone. We're at the dawn of this century that's going to be defined by three or four big global powers that, you know, are going to be using the internet as a massive extension of their geopolitical power. And right now, whenever I go to a government, they say, how do we recreate Silicon Valley? How do we have the next company of like yours in our country? And so when I come to the US and I look at the amazing kind of behemoths of tech that are doing so much innovation, so much investment, and creating so many jobs, And I see people talking about losing the regulatory framework that gave you that when the rest of the world is begging for a little bit of that kind of magic. I think that's it's a strange position for me to be in, where, you know, the second piece of that is free expression is at the heart of our industries for a lot of people who didn't have access to the kind of speech they now have access to through companies like Twitter being available. We can't afford to lose that. And I think the real worry is that you start moving down a path that then gets, if you lose this global open internet and you start having a more fragmented internet, then that's going to be colossally damaging, not just for speech around the world, but also for kind of open democratic norms.
How would you describe Twitter's relationship with Washington right now?
Busy, having come straight from the Hill. The tech industry hasn't done a great job explaining its approach. It hasn't done a great job engaging with the absolutely legitimate concerns of, you know, that constituents are presenting to lawmakers, whether it's about content, whether it's about kind of regulation, whether it's about things they see on the platforms, it's about, you know, things that affect their accounts. They've been locked out and they can't get back in. So it's incumbent on us to kind of go with an open mind, talk to lawmakers, talk to policymakers, and ask, look, what are the challenges that you're trying to solve? How can we be part of the solution? And I think the worry for me right now is we're in an environment where that conversation about how can we craft good solutions, that all over the world, that noise, there's a lot of noise and not a lot of light. And I think we need to try get to a point where it's like, we have shared goals here. How do we find policy solutions that actually defend our values and solve challenges, rather than necessarily, you know, penalizing the companies who are in front of you? Because the risk is you do that, they're the only companies in front of you.
Do you think the conversation is trending in that direction of a realization of shared goals?
I think the Christchurch call is a good example, actually. You know, you've got governments, whether it's the UK government, the New Zealand government, the French government, and then you've got companies like, you know, Twitter, Amazon, Facebook, and then civil society groups.
One of the significant global efforts Nick pointed to is something called the Christchurch Call. As part of that mass shooting, the perpetrator live-streamed video of this atrocity. And in response, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, and the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, came up with a voluntary agreement that asks the social media companies to really combat the spread of violent terrorist content on platforms like Facebook and Twitter. And the idea behind that call is that there's a way of balancing not having violent, horrific content on these platforms with the free flow of information and free speech.
That, I think that's real progress, and that's pretty unique. And I think the conversation that companies have, I think we're all just much more open now. And I think that's it's an absolutely long overdue change.
So part of Congressman Khanna's argument is that we need smart, thoughtful regulation of Silicon Valley. And he says that's not happening in part because his colleagues simply don't get technology. Here's the congressman again.
If someone was testifying as a doctor and people were asking them, well, is my heart located in my feet? People would laugh. And that's the level of sophistication that many members of Congress showed. They didn't know what apps were. They didn't know that Apple made the iPhone and not Google. They didn't know that Facebook sold ads. Most junior high school students have a greater knowledge and technology than many of the members of Congress.
When you talk to companies back in your district, are they open to these sorts of solutions?
They are. I mean, they will point out that they are very sensitive to First Amendment concerns. They don't want a news clip, for example, that has hate speech in it, but is part of a broadcast on international news to be censored. They don't want a political perspective that may be offensive to an individual censored. I mean, they point out that someone's terrorist may be another person's freedom fighter. And so there is definitely concern about the boundaries between freedom of expression versus not having speech that is hurtful to individuals. And the reality is artificial intelligence can't make those judgments. So it does require perhaps initial tagging through a program, but then ultimately human review.
Their decision-making on some of the content questions sometimes from the outside looks chaotic. As their representative in Congress, how do you explain sort of how that goes down?
Well, it is very difficult, and it's probably not something that they want to do. They probably want Congress to step in and create some guidelines, and they probably need some consortium or some ethical guidelines from academics and civil society. I mean, most of these folks were engineers or business leaders who didn't take courses on what is truth and what is deliberative democracy. And now they're being asked to be guardians of a speech. That's a very difficult issue, and many of them don't want that responsibility. And the default has been, well, let anything go. But that in itself is making a decision by not regulating speech. I mean, we regulate speech all the time. When I have a town hall, someone can't just yell and hurl insults based on race or gender or religion at other participants. That's a regulation of speech that we think is helpful for democracy. And so the question becomes, what is social media's responsibility in democratic forums?
So, Nancy, what will you be watching for the next weeks or months on this issue?
Two things. One is that these questions about what counts as misinformation, what counts as bullying, hate speech on platforms like Facebook and Twitter are only going to become more fraught for these companies as we get closer to Election Day. The second thing is it's become clear that other countries aren't waiting around for the United States to make these decisions. Really, we're taking the lead from the rest of the world. So even as a Washington-based U.S. tech policy reporter, I'm keeping an eye on places like New Zealand, France, even Asia, to see what kind of rules they're coming up with around social media.
Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you, Louisa.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you're listening on Politico.com, go to Politico.com/globaltranslations to learn how to get the show on your phone or other mobile device. Thanks to my colleague, Nancy Scola. Our producer is Patricia Jacob. We had help on this episode from Annie Reese. Dave Shaw is the executive producer of Politico Audio. I'm Louisa Savage. Global Translations is presented by Citi, a leading global bank. Listen for a branded episode from Citi about some of these same themes coming Thursday, August 1st. And I'll be back on August 15th as we begin to look at another big global issue, climate change. We'll hear key voices from the U.S. and around the world on where we are and where we're headed, and whether or not America has ceded global leadership on this issue.